Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's call. At that time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the meeting over to Brady Phillips. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining this monthly climate update call, which is part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. Again, my name is Brady Phillips. I'm a public affairs officer with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, D.C., and I'll be facilitating the call today. During the call, we will feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. And a copy of the presentation can be found online at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BRIEFINGS. Our first presenter is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina. We'll provide a summary of the January U.S. and global climate reports, followed by Rick Thoman. He's a climate science and services manager located at NOAA's National Weather Service office, or the Alaska region in Anchorage. And finally, we'll have Hoog Vandendul, a seasonal forecaster with the NOAA Climate Prediction Center's Operational Prediction Branch in College Park, Maryland. He'll provide an El Nino update as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks over the coming 3 months through May. So we'll begin with Jay Crouch from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. Jake?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number two, looking at the global temperatures of January 2016. January 2016 was the warmest January on record for the globe. This marks the ninth consecutive month that we have broken the global temperature record. This is the first time since 1997-98 that we've had nine consecutive record warm months for the globe. Looking at the temperature for January across the global surface, it was 1.04 degrees Celsius, warmer than the 20th century average. This is the second largest departure from average behind December of 2015. And that departure is also only the second time that we've exceeded the 1.0 degrees Celsius threshold. Land surfaces for January were second warmest on record, while the ocean surface was the record warm for the month of January. The map on the right shows how these temperatures were distributed across the globe. We did have much of the global surface that was record and near record warm. Some notable locations, including the Indian Ocean, extending into southern Asia, much of southern and northern Africa, northern South America, and parts of Central America were record warm, while we saw cooler than average conditions across the northern Atlantic, parts of western Russia extending into Central Asia that were cooler than average, as well as portions of the southern oceans. Moving on to slide number three, this shows January temperatures departure from average back to 1880. We see that January 2016 is quite a bit above the previous record that was set in 2007, and we beat the previous record by 0.16 degrees Celsius. So 2016 is off to a really warm start, coming off of 2015, which was a record warm year. So we're already ahead of the pack when we look at 2016 compared to just last year. Looking at what's going on in the U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands on slide number four, this part of the globe has been dealing with quite a significant drought dating back about 4 or 5 months. Many of these islands need to receive a minimum threshold of precipitation each month to meet their water needs. These islands don't have much water storage, so just a few months of below average precipitation can have huge impacts in terms of what's happening on those islands. Several locations have been record and near record dry for January, dating back to early autumn. This map on the right shows locations precipitation compared to average. Karor, Pago Pago, Yap have all been record and near record dry for January and the past 4 to 5 months. And the Republic of the Marshall Islands has declared a state of emergency due to this drought, with only a few weeks of water left on several of the atolls, with 13 of the atolls asking for assistance from the government. So even though many people don't live in these locations, this is quite a significant impact in terms of the drought and water resources in those locations. Moving on to slide number 5, to look at what happened here in the U.S. during January 2016. January was slightly warmer and drier than average on the whole for the lower 48. The map on the left shows the breakdown of temperatures during January. The northern parts of the contiguous U.S. tended to be warmer than average, while the southern plains to the southeast and mid-Atlantic tended to be near average to slightly below average. Looking at precipitation on the right and how it broke down across the contiguous U.S. during January, we did see below-average precipitation for much of the central U.S. extending into the Midwest and Northeast. Ohio did have its ninth driest January. We did see above-average precipitation in the West. The West has been dealing with drought going on 4 to 5 years now, and even though the beneficial precipitation slightly improved drought conditions, many locations are still dealing with long-term water shortages. And we see in the Southeast, Florida was fairly wet with its fourth wettest January on record. And as many of you on the East Coast probably remember, we did have a major winter storm impact the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast from January 22nd through 24th. And looking at our NESIS scale, which looks at snowfall relative to population and to measure the societal impacts, that winter storm was the fourth most impactful storm since 1950 to impact the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast. Moving on to slide number 6 to look at drought conditions. This is the U.S. Drought Monitor report that was released this morning. 15.1% of the lower 48 is in drought. This is the lowest drought footprint since October of 2010, and the drought footprint has shrank about 3.7% since late December. We have seen improvements in drought across parts of the West, as I mentioned, with that above-average precipitation, but many locations, particularly in California, continue to have long-term precipitation deficits, with most of California still in drought, and about 40% of California in the worst category of drought even this morning. We did see drought degrade in parts of the northern plains as well as parts of the southern plains during 2016 so far. And outside of the contiguous U.S., Hawaii has been pretty dry for much of 2016. Honolulu had one of its driest Januaries on record, receiving only 1.01 inches of precipitation during the month. And so we've seen drought conditions expand for the islands. And with that, I will pass it off to Rick.
Okay, thanks, Jake. We're up to slide number 7 now. And some Alaska highlights for you so far this winter. Mark Twain reputedly quipped that climate's what you expect, but weather's what you get. And this winter has not brought much of what we expect to Alaska. This is shaping up to be the third consecutive winter to be significantly warmer than normal. And like last year, but unlike 2013-14, the warmth covers the entire state. For the November through January early winter season, every single long-term climate site in Alaska was significantly warmer than normal. And overall, the NCEI ranked this as the third warmest early winter season since 1925-26. And after a wet and in many places snowy autumn, this winter has been very dry across Alaska. There's also been several significant storms across the state this winter, although these have been more windbags than associated with significant precipitation. Back in December, you may recall that we had one of the deepest storms of record hit the Bering Sea and produced damage to the Aleutian Islands and Pribilofs. Southeast Alaska saw a damaging wind storm in late January, and just this past week, a blizzard on the North Slope shut things down. There were no flights in or out of Barrow on Friday and Saturday, and it's certainly milder than normal, but we are still talking about the Arctic. Moving on to slide 8, here's a plot of Climate Division precipitation rankings from NCEI for the December-January period, and you can see precipitation has been sparse over much of the state. That fire engine red there in the central interior marks this as the driest December, January in the 91 years of analysis for Alaska. And you can see it's a top five driest elsewhere in northern and western Alaska. Only one division was significantly wetter than normal. That's that green area along the northwest Gulf Coast. That includes the communities of Kodiak and Seward. And this is a pretty typical pattern during El Nino winters and reflects persistent southeasterly winds aloft that bring that moisture onto east and southeast facing coasts, but then much of that moisture is stripped out crossing the mountains, resulting in the drier conditions on the windward side of the terrain. Moving on now to slide 9. If it's been warm and dry, it's probably not a big surprise that snowfall is low. But this winter is really unusual. Both Fairbanks and Anchorage have had far below normal snowfall since the beginning of December. And for both cities, these are record low values up through yesterday. The capital city of Juneau has not had any measurable snow since before New Year's, making this the longest winter streak without accumulating snow at the Juneau Airport. So if snowfall is so low, how come in this graphic at the right there shows Alaska's snowpack in large areas is near or even above normal? That's the blue and green colors there. And the answer, of course, is that over much of Alaska, except for southern coastal areas, the snowpack starts to build during the autumn. Many parts of Alaska had a very snowy autumn indeed. So this was especially so in November. Some places had record-high snows. Late September was also unusually snowy in parts of the interior, and at higher elevations, that snow did not melt away, and so is now part of the winter snow cover. There are a few areas, such as in the immediate Anchorage area, where snow cover is, again, very low compared to normal. But overall, Alaska is in better shape snow-wise than last year's pitiful season. Up to slide 10 now. One of the most commonly asked questions that we get is, you know, is it cold in Alaska this winter? And that's, of course, a very difficult question to answer since Alaska is so large and has such a diversity of climates from Arctic tundra to temperate rainforest. So to help answer this, we've developed this temperature index on the slide here. And this is based on 26 statewide locations selected to be as geographically representative as possible. And it accounts for differences in the variability between coastal and inland areas. And conveniently, it also allows us to keep track of day-to-day temperature trends from a statewide perspective. Really a remarkable feature about this plot, as you can see there, has been the persistence of the warmth. Since the beginning of November, nearly 70% of days have been significantly warmer than normal. That's the red dots. And the last day that was significantly colder than normal over Alaska as a whole, that's the blue dots, was back on Christmas Eve. And this is reflected in individual locations as well. Anchorage has only had one day since New Year's with a daily temperature even slightly below normal. And Seldovia on the southern Kenai Peninsula is now at 67 days in a row and counting with above normal temperatures. And I'll finish up with slide 11. Really, maybe the most outstanding feature of the winter has been the complete absence of any deep cold weather in Alaska. As you see in this slide, a number of long-term climate sites, the lowest temperatures so far this winter are warmer than any winter of record. And in many other locations, it's close to the warmest lowest winter temperatures. So, for instance, just to explain this down there at Bethel, the low so far has been 7 below. Now, climate observations have been made at Bethel since the early 20s, and no winter has had a lowest temperature higher than 13 below. Fairbanks has only had one winter in the past 110 years when it's failed to get to 30 below or lower, and this might be the second time. And when we look at all of the various FAA airport weather stations, weather service sites, NCEI climate reference network sites, the lowest reported temperature in Alaska so far has just been 47 below Arctic Village back in December. And how unusual is that? Well, there's not been a single winter in the last century when someplace in Alaska didn't get to at least 50 below. But you should note, though, these temperatures are so, quote, warm that it would be entirely possible for lower temperatures to occur at some point in the next 6 weeks. And so on that hopeful note, I'll send it over to Hoog.
Okay, thank you, Rick. I'm speaking now to slide number 12. This is about the sea surface temperature globally and the state of ENSO. As you can see in the upper left on slide number 12, the sea surface temperature is above normal or has been above normal in the last 1 month from mid-January to mid-February, as it has been for the last 6 months or so, in particular in the tropical Pacific Ocean from the dateline to the South American coast. So this is evidence of the strong El Nino still going on. It has peaked more or less. We zoom around December and it is declining, but it is not declining very fast. So we still have sea surface temperature anomalies of 2 and more degrees. And in association with that, there is very strong convection over the East Pacific and the Central Pacific, which forces patterns in the atmosphere to be quite abnormal. You will also see in the extratropical oceans quite a bit of warm water, for example, along the west coast of all of North America, and also in the Atlantic off the east coast, the water is quite warm. So the El Nino advisory remains in place for the moment. The diagram on the lower left shows you that as long as you see this dominant red bar of the three choices of blue, green, and red, we expect an El Nino to be in place by the criterion of at least half a degree anomaly in that ENSO box. And so we will go to neutral is the forecast around May, June, July, somewhere in that framework. And we have a chance of roughly 50% to be in a La Nina by the end of the summer or by the fall season of 2016. And some of the projections you cannot see here, which go out a little further, put that number at 80% for next winter of being in a La Nina. So that's more or less the state of the ocean. The extratropical oceans will continue to be warm, although not everywhere, not always in the same spot. If we go to slide number 13, which looks a whole lot like slide number 14, so one is the monthly forecast for North America, for the U.S., all states on the continent. So you can see we are predicting much of the same for Alaska to continue above normal temperatures for the month of March. Similarly, for the northern tier of states with the highest probabilities in the northwest, much of the southeast, the greater southeast, has equal chances, which means no tilt to above or below normal, except a small area of below normal in the southern plains in Texas. So the precipitation, as does the temperature, follows pretty much the El Nino composite that you expect on the basis of all the previous El Niños that have taken place. So we expect above median precipitation across the south with a probability, for example, of somewhat over 40% across Southern California where it would be needed most. But the highest probability is really in Florida where the impacts of ENSO work out with more certainty than any other place in the country. The pattern for Alaska looks a lot like what has been observed in January and February. If we go to slide number 14, I can be very brief because basically the forecast for the three-month periods, March, April, May, is pretty much similar to the one for March alone. So this is the impact of ENSO. If you were to go to the next season, which we don't have a slide of here, but we produce those, it's going to fade out that pattern into the summer. So the slide number 15 gives you the drought outlook, and the area that has colors is pretty small because the coverage of the drought monitor, as was commented earlier by Jake, is very small at the moment. That's primarily because we had so much precipitation in October and November. So January and February have not been particularly wet, but the drought monitor has small coverage still because of the plentiful rains earlier in late 2015. So So the persistent drought in the West, and particularly in California, should improve some if the forecast were to verify that I just discussed. So in much of central California and central western Nevada, things would improve, but it would not be eliminated. So there are only small areas of green where the drought would actually disappear if the forecast verifies. And in southeastern California and in northern California and eastern Oregon, basically we're not predicting a whole lot of change in the state of the drought monitor. Hawaii is dry and will stay dry. But there's no, there is actually some drought development. That's the only one on the whole map that's for Hawaii, further development. Okay, so this is my last slide, and I'll turn it back to Brady, I believe.
Thank you, Hugh. We'll now take specific questions from the call participants. Again, please be sure to indicate who you'd like to answer the question, if at all possible. Operator, please remind the participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first call, please.
Sure. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. And our first question is from Brian Sullivan. Your line is now open.
Hi. If we go into neutral or La Nina conditions by the end of 2016, what would be some of the impacts that we could see on the global weather patterns and specifically in the U.S.?
Okay, I'm assuming that question is for me, Hugh Vandendoel. So if you look at our forecast out of the CPC site, which go out to leads of 12 months ahead of time, you will see indeed the more or less typical impacts of a La Nina over the United States showing up with low probability. So that would be warm across the north and cold across the south, and dry across the south and wet across the north, but with some details that I cannot discuss here, but that's basically, that would be the impact of a La Nina. So we are playing that at the moment with low confidence starting roughly in the fall of 2016.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question is from Craig Miller. Your line is now open.
Thanks. Since you have said now that that El Nino has peaked and is weakening, are you prepared to make a pronouncement about where this one falls on the record books compared to, say, 97, 98, some of the others?
This is Hugh Vandendoel. Well, this is something that's going to be debated, of course, for some time, particularly in scientific meetings. If you base this only on the SST anomaly in this sensitive area, which is called Niño 3.4, this appears to be at least on par with 1997, 98. If you include other variables like the response in the wind and the convection in the atmosphere, the comparison is more complicated, and it may not be the biggest on record, or at least not so far. The other previous very big event was in 82, 83, and I think we are still discussing whether or not that one was bigger than 97, 98, so I think we should include that one also in the comparison. There are some differences in seasonality, you know, how they build and peak and so on, but it is fairly typical for these El Nino events, even the weaker ones, to have the largest amplitude in SST around December and then decline. So that appears to have happened also this year, although the decline so far is weak. And so that may contribute to an overall impression of this event being really strong. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any comments on the ridge and blob?
Well, you mean the ridge over the west?
Yes.
Well, that wouldn't be too typical for an El Nino. So in-house here at the Climate Prediction Center, we are not overjoyed over the response over the United States. But one has to live with what nature is dishing us out. So that ridge shouldn't be there all the time. There should have been some more undercutting and rainfall anomalies over Southern California. So we are predicting that to happen in March. So we're not giving up hope, so to speak. We are just going for the tools without our emotions. Thank you.
Our next question is from Andrea Thompson. Your line is now open.
Hi, yes. I was wondering, I guess, Jake, if you could kind of talk about, you know, it mentions the drought crisis in the Pacific Islands. That's related to El Nino. Like, what exactly the teleconnection is? Is it because it's of the way it shifts the rains kind of away from that area, or?
Yes, this is Jake. So usually when we're in an El Nino, we tend to see suppressed convection in this part of the globe, and most of the precipitation that falls in the U.S. Pacific Islands is convective. And so without the convection in place or the suppressed convection, that leads to the below-average precipitation totals. As Hoog mentioned, if we are moving into a La Nina later in the year, hopefully that would mean the opposite would be true, that we would see enhanced convection in this part of the globe. So there is hope in the long term. But as I mentioned, you know, water storage is pretty limited in this part of the globe. So hopefully things will change or turn around sooner rather than later for the U.S. islands in the Pacific.
Great, thanks.
At this time, I'd like to remind all participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question is from Emily Gertz. Your line is now open.
This question is for Rick and, I guess, Jake. Given the record high temperatures in Alaska and the continued drought in parts of the West, what is the outlook for fire season this year?
This is Rick Tolman. In Alaska, there is basically no correlation between the overwinter snowpack and the total acreage burned. Fire in Alaska very dependent on the weather during the summer. That being said, given that we're in better shape snowpack-wise than we were last year, if we have a warm spring, and we get an early melt, it could lead to an early start to the fire season. But overall, we just can't how much snow we have on the ground really isn't correlated to how bad the total season will be.
Okay. And Jake, can you make any informed sort of estimates on what might happen in California, Oregon, and Washington?
This is Jake. So Rick's answer for Alaska kind of holds true for the western U.S., where a mountain snowpack really can influence the upcoming wildfire season. And snowpack totals in the west, even though the precipitation totals themselves haven't been too impressive, snowpack is faring pretty well across the Sierra Nevadas and the Cascades. Local weather, you know, day-to-day, synoptic weather to weekly patterns really influence wildfire weather, and so it's kind of hard to make that connection from what's happening now to what we can expect during the warmer months.
Our next question is from Rhea Misra. Your line is now open.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if you could comment on how strong this coming La Nina might be. Does the fact that we just had a very, very strong El Nino suggest that this will also possibly be a very strong La Nina?
Okay, this is Hugh Van Den Doel. I think it's too early to make pronouncements about the strength of the La Nina. We aren't even sure that it will happen. So we have an 80% probability of a La Nina for the winter of 16/17. But that requires only a temperature anomaly of minus 0.5 degrees C. So I wouldn't go much beyond that. So we have a whole lot of different tools nowadays. We have dynamical models from 7 or 8 centers across North America and, in fact, the globe to forecast these things, as well as the more empirical tools. And there is a great variety in answers, so it would also depend a little bit on who you ask the question. But some models even refuse to go to negative anomalies, so they just simply decay the warm event and then stay undecided for the entire year 2016. But a small majority will go negative, so we are reasonably confident that there will be a La Nina. And at this time, we plead ignorance as to whether this is going to be a small, moderate, or strong La Nina.
Right.
Thank you.
Does the historical data suggest that there's ever a correlation between the strength of El Nino and La Nina, or does that not speak for very much?
I'm not absolutely sure about the answer, but I would guess that correlation is pretty weak.
Okay.
Of course, you can refer to the 97-98 event. There you had a fairly strong cold event following a very strong warm event. So there are such examples. But other cases happen independently. 88-89 was a very strong cold event, but not really following a very strong warm event. And the analysis is also complicated by the fact that these cold events, they sometimes happen 2, even 3 years in a row, while the warm events are usually only 1 year. So that's one of the reasons that we are quite certain that this will go neutral, because we don't have extended periods of warm events, typically in the historical record, which is only 150 years, but that's all we can rely on.
Great, thank you.
Our next question is from Craig Miller. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks for the second shot here. I'm just curious if Hugh or Jake, either one of you, has any analysis of why the usual precipitation pattern for El Nino in California seems to be flipped this year. Then Southern California actually got less precipitation, has been getting less precipitation.
Okay, this is Hugh Vandenhul. I'll take a little shot, and maybe Jake can add to that. Well, the analysis of that sort of thing is called attribution, and that's probably going to take place in the next couple of seasons to figure out why this didn't work out as canonical as we expressed in our original forecast. But, I mean, one of the elements is, of course, exactly where are these convection anomalies in the atmosphere in response to the warm seawater. And they are a little farther to the west than they typically are, so that would be one element to consider. A second element that I'm sure will be mentioned is, what is a warm event in the tropical Pacific going to work out in the presence of global warming as well? With reference to the sea surface temperature map, you can see that a lot of the globe is in a warm state. And that is probably different from what it was in 82, 83, or 97, 98. And some of the warmth in the, say, in the North Pacific projects onto patterns that a third group of people may want to comment on, like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. So whether or not this is all ENSO or that it is a combination with other modes, that is a topic that needs to be discussed. It probably cannot be answered with full certainty even after that, but at this point, I'm just telling you where the uncertainty lies. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
At this time, I'd like to remind all participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
Okay, if there are no more questions, if somebody does have one while I'm finishing up, you could put your name in the queue and we'll call on you. Otherwise, I will end the call with a couple of reminders. Please mark your calendar for the U.S. climate highlights for the month of February, which will be released on March 8th. And then coming up on March 17, we will release the global climate highlights for the month of February. And also next month at this time, instead of having our monthly climate call, we will have the National Weather Service will be issuing its spring/flooding outlook for the United States. So that will is tentatively scheduled for 11 o'clock a.m. on March 17th. A separate media advisory will be put out for that call. A couple more reminders. Today, we just launched a new look on NOAA.gov, so if you haven't gone there, please check out our new site. And for particularly for media, if you're looking for recordings of this call within about an hour and a half or so, if you go to the NOAA.gov, there is a section for media, and if you go to the lower left, it says news and features. If you click on that and then go to the far right, there you'll find the media advisory. It will be posted there. So again, when in doubt, look about and explore the new site. Also, I did want to mention one more website. So within the last couple of weeks, climate.gov. So if you go to climate.gov/ENSO, that's E-N-S-O, we did attempt to put all of our El Nino-related topical links on one kind of site, and that does include our El Nino blog. So I think somebody had asked a question of, is this the strongest El Nino on record or what? So if you go to the February 11th blog, you know, it's kind of, it is a complicated answer, and it kind of goes into detail there. So I do encourage you for El Nino to look at our ENSO page. And as we start moving into La Nina, more La Nina products will be posted there as well. So again, that's just a good one-stop shop for El Nino, La Nina, and kind of all things ENSO. And I actually do have one more question, so I will have, since we do have a couple minutes, I'll go to that final one, and then we'll terminate the call. So, operator, queue up just the last question.
Yes, the next question is from Hunter Cutting. Your line is now open.
Hi there. Thanks for taking one more question. This is regarding the precipitation up in Alaska and looking at slide 8. You guys note that it's a typical El Nino pattern, though magnified. And I guess this sort of is in line with the earlier question about how this interacts with other factors like PDO or climate change. And so specifically, is this consistent with the direction of precipitation trends under the projections of climate change?
This is Rick Tolman. So, you know, as you kind of alluded to there, the blob kind of has morphed into a very canonical positive PDO pattern with warm water near shore from Alaska around the west coast of North America and then hooking back towards Hawaii, and then cooler than average sea surface temperatures in the central Pacific. And again, that's typical during a significant El Nino event. The PDO pattern and ENSO are not statistically independent. So to the extent that this is typical of ENSO, you know, this is not surprising. But again, I would, you know, just refer back. We had a very wet November, so there's certainly no multi-decadal scale trends towards drier over Alaska in the wintertime and wetter in the autumn or anything like that. This is really quite typical for this specific setup of tropical Pacific sea surface temperatures driving the atmosphere, and we're seeing quite a typical response in the North Pacific.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we will end the call. If you do have further questions or need follow-up, please feel free to email Katie Matthews, that's katie.matthews@noaa.gov, or me, brady.philips@noaa.gov. And again, thank you for your participation. This concludes the call. Goodbye.
This now concludes today's conference. All lines may disconnect at this time. Thank you.